Hello, once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. We welcome back astronomer Bob Berman today in a busy time in the astronomical world right now. A probe is going to land on a comet, which I find fascinating. We'll talk about that. Also, the supermoon coming up and Bob's new book, Zoom, How Everything Moves from Atoms and Galaxies to Blizzards and Bees. It's on Little Brown. Number to call here with your astronomical question, 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Bob Berman, welcome back. Nice book.
Well, thank you, Ray. Great to be here.
I mean, I haven't read it yet, but the cover is very nice.
Okay.
So what's it all about, Alfie?
Well, everything natural that moves. And I learned a lot during the year and a half of research I had to do, how that germs can go across a kitchen counter in just an hour, that they swim that fast. I had no idea of that. And all different aspects, shifting poles, how fast molasses moves, like that big molasses accident back in Boston almost a century ago. And wow, almost every aspect of it. Who was the first person who told us why the wind blows? Stuff like that.
So this is not really, this is your first book, not really about the cosmos in general?
Right, right. Only a couple chapters are about things like meteors and also tiny things that penetrate our bodies, cosmic rays and the consequences and vibrations, like why your car gets hot when it's parked in sunlight. It all has to do with the glass vibrating and infrared vibrations. And almost all of it is about other aspects of nature that are not astronomical.
However, I do notice a chapter in there is about the movement of the poles, and that's something we've talked about often on the program.
Right. That brings the people who are not content to worry about their high potassium levels or cholesterol or
right.
things like that. The shifting poles, because actually they've never shifted as fast as they are. They're moving 37 miles a year. That's pretty darn fast.
Yeah.
And so what does that mean? Is that really worrisome? Who are the first people to reach the poles? And do most people even know there's two sets of poles? You know, there's the geographic one and the magnetic pole.
Right.
Or that Henry Hudson, just a few short years after he discovered that river that Sully Sullenberg landed in, was the closest person to reach the pole until his crew mutinied and put him and his son out in a little boat in what we now call Hudson Bay, and they were never heard from again.
Wow. An ignoble end to a nice career.
Right.
Well, you know, you'd sell more books if you would say the pole shifting around so fast is obviously disastrous.
Right.
Did your publisher say that by any chance?
No. And it doesn't really seem so, since every time that there's even been a flip of Earth's magnetic orientation, in other words, South Pole becomes North and vice versa, they just don't match up with times where we've had mass extinctions or big changes in the biosphere. So apparently those things happen independent of us life form. I mean, pigeons would fly around a little dazed probably and confused, but other than that, it doesn't seem to hurt us.
Number to call here is 1-800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest. We've been speaking about his new book, Zoom, How Everything Moves, and some exciting stuff going on. Ooh, I don't know how many millions or billions of miles away it is right now, but the comet with the Russian name that I can't remember or pronounce, if I could remember, is going to be landed upon by a probe.
Yeah, and this is exciting. The Europeans really did a good one on this one. It's been traveling for years and years with gravity boosts from two different planets. And to actually have our first views of it, I think most people have seen the pictures that have been in the New York Times and elsewhere. Now it's closer than 60 miles from it. And we've never had such a close-up look of this several-mile-wide nucleus. It looks a little like an hourglass. And part of it is actually going to attach itself to the surface. This is groundbreaking. It's going to rewrite the book about comets.
What do they hope to learn by doing this?
Well, we're going to learn almost everything about them, because although we've had close visits of comets before, this is the first time we're going to be right there on the surface and right nearby watching it as it approaches the sun, so that the ices are going to start to sublimate, steam is going to come out, the tail will be generated. We're going to watch the process from the first step to the last step.
Yeah.
And It'll never be the same again, our thoughts about comets. We've always known that they were dirty snowballs, really just mostly ice with embedded dust. And now we're going to actually see the thing happen.
Now, my concern, of course, in a science fiction realm is, by landing on it, can you very minutely change the orbital path of this thing and perhaps put the Earth in harm's way?
Well, that's a good question. But even though it's just a few miles across, the mass, the weight of it, it's always a question of how much nudge are you going to give it. If you land this spacecraft somewhat gently, which it has to be, otherwise the lander would be destroyed, how much of a push are you going to give it? And it's really not. It's sort of like a flea hitting the windshield of your truck
okay.
while you're driving down the highway.
All right, so no big deal.
No.
All right, let's go to the phones, 1-800-348-2551. Linda in Old Chatham. Hi, Linda, you're on.
Oh, hello. I'd like to know, I heard on Stardate on WAMC about the dominant star in the constellation Libra and some connection to Scorpio called Zubanel Janubi.
Yes.
I thought that was a fascinating name. I want to name my new cat that.
That's great.
Good, good. Yes, the two brightest stars in Libra, Alpha and Beta Libri, are Zubanel Janubi and Zubanesh Shamali.
Yes.
This is like Dizzy Gillespie scat singing, by the way. Zubanel Janubi.
And Zuban. And these are Arabic names, meaning the northern and the southern claw. Because even though it's part of Libra, Libra used to be considered part of Scorpius. Of course, we astronomers say Scorpius. The astrologers say Scorpio. But it used to be that the front claws extended all the way into what we call Libra. If not, that would be a real science fiction, scary horror image of a scale, Libra the scales, having claws.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We don't want our scales to have claws.
No.
But that's what those two stars mean. Currently, though, there's one bright thing in Libra, and that's the planet Saturn. So if you see a bright star there, you're looking at Saturn. Neither of those two stars, which are really not very bright, they're only second magnitude.
Fascinating. I just loved the name.
Yeah, that's great. Well, I hope you do name your cat, and if you do, please call in the Pets and Vets later on in the month.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Love the show. Hey, I can't wait to read that book.
Yeah, it seems to be a good one. And again, the cover is fabulous. And I've only looked at the chapter titles, but it's a fat book with just enough illustrations to keep radio people interested. It's going to be nice.
I have a special interest in that I'm not going to name, but I'm going to look for it.
Cool.
Thank
right.
you.
Thanks
Thank
a lot,
you.
Linda. We appreciate the call. Let's go over to Ted in Albany. Ted, you're on.
Yeah, you stole my question.
What do you mean, man?
I was going to ask if there were any Heisenberg properties to what's going on with the comet and the probe.
All right, what's a Heisenberg property again?
That's well, when we're changing something as we observe it. For example, landing the probe on the comet. What about the gravity of the Rosetta itself?
Hmm.
Well, no, that's not enough to change this, even though it's a small object. Granted, it's a very small object, only a couple of miles apart, too small to be spherical. You know, you've got a minimum
right.
mass to even be a ball, and this is way below that.
Don't you need some mass to actually orbit something? To be in a, I know that they're planning to orbit this thing.
Yes.
Isn't there, there's got to be enough mass to orbit it, right?
Yeah, but you really don't need much. For example, in space, if the two of us were hanging in space, we could even orbit each other just from that little bit of pull. As
That's
long as
disturbing,
we,
Bob. We'd, Thanks.
We'd have
that.
To go very slowly.
Yeah.
But the caller is bringing up something, you know, very cool. I mean, the Heisenberg business and what he's implying is that the observation changes what's being observed. Here, we're not just benignly looking at it. Of course, we're pushing on.
We're putting physical exertion
yeah, right,
on it.
Right.
So, yeah, that was my point. However, while you're on the line here, Ted, I'm told that this comet is rather loosely put together. Even though it looks like a rock when you see the pictures, it's fairly loose. What's the danger of this probe going straight on through?
No. It's not. They're not that loose, we don't think. But we're going to find out. That's the cool thing about that. When we actually anchor the probe down and analyze it, we're going to answer questions we've never known before. I mean, comets are
Maybe
unique.
Even know to ask.
Yeah.
That's right. I mean, we know that way out in the outer reaches of the solar system, there's the Oort cloud, this repository of icy bodies, and that occasionally through their mutual gravity or collisions, or perhaps a distant star passing by, some of them are thrown inward, and that replenishes the comets that are otherwise being gobbled up by the sun. Every time a comet comes close to the sun, some of its ice is sublimated, it loses some of its mass, and so comets have a short shelf life, you know, usually just some thousands of years. So there has to be a reservoir of them to replenish the ones, and so that's what we're going to find out.
All right, Ted, thanks a lot for the call. Now, in reading up on this particular experiment that is 10 years now in the making, I have learned that comets, as they move closer to the sun, develop two ion jets in the back, and that's different than the tail that we see, right?
That's right. There's typically an ion tail, or sometimes called a plasma tail, and then there's the dust tail, because as the dust is being released, and sunlight has a pressure on it. So the sunlight pushes on it, and the tail always points away from the sun. But at the same time, some of the material is being ionized, so then you get a form of gas, broken bits of atoms, actually, that go in a different direction. So one points directly away from the sun, and the other tail kind of follows the orbit that it was in. So the two tails diverge a little bit and separate from each other, and one is bluish, one tends to be whitish, and in some cases you really have a gorgeous double tail.
Fascinating.
And, yeah.
Well, we'll learn more in days ahead. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Bob Berman is our guest. Number to call is 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We'll be back.
Support comes from Edward Garbasek, Certified Financial Planner, Havoc and Wealth Strategies, Wilbraham, Massachusetts, providing customized financial retirement strategies for those approaching or in retirement. HavocandWealthStrategies.com. Rhinebeck Artist Shops, Rhinebeck and New Paltz, providing professional picture framing, fine art materials for students, professionals, and the public. The Atwater Art Gallery upstairs in Rhinebeck, RhinebeckArt.com. Interim Healthcare, providing companions, aides, and nurses in the home 2 to 24 hours a day so you or a loved one can stay in your home. Serving the Capital Region, Columbia County, Glens Falls, and Saratoga. InterimHealthcare.com. And Turning Stone, partnering with the Oneida Nation, presenting the Nota Begay, the Third Foundation Challenge, a golf benefit supporting Native American children. August 27th, TurningStone.com.
One 1-800-348-2551 is the number here on Vox Pop. Zoom, How Everything Moves from Atoms and Galaxies to Blizzards and Bees is the new book by astronomer Bob Berman. Bob is here with us once again. Bob, you're back from Chile already?
Oh, no. I haven't gone yet.
The last time, I thought you said you were going to Chile.
That'll be at the end of October, bringing a group. You know, it's a much smaller group than last year. Last year, we had that criminal comet ISON that fell apart.
Well, you can't blame you got to blame the sun.
Right. So we had about 90 people joining us, and this time it looks like more like a dozen. So, hey, everybody, come on.
There's
with
room.
Us to Chile.
There's room and, on the Berman bus.
Right, right. Berman tours. That's how they find it. But the point is, Chile is so, the skies are so amazing. That's why everybody's building observatories down there. The Atacama Desert is great. The Andes Mountains. So we go in these little valleys, these green valleys, and we've rented out an entire mountaintop with giant telescopes that
cool.
are just ours for a few nights. And
when
the
is
skies,
this trip?
At the end of October and early November, we go in the dark of the moon, and the Milky Way is so bright down there that you cast your shadow. You see your shadow by Milky Way light.
Wow. Fascinating.
It's the best skies ever. That's why it's so exciting.
1-800-348-2551 is our number. Bob Berman is our guest. Let's go to Anna in Niskayuna. You're on.
Hello?
Line 3 always seems to be problematic. Are you there? Anna?
Yeah. How are you going to land the probe on the comet?
Okay. Bob, how are you going to land your probe on the comet?
A question asked with helium breathing in
no,
helium.
No, this is, I think, a youngster. How old are you, Anna?
I'm 8.5.
Oh, well, that
so
explains
so cool that
it.
You're
okay.
listening. We love it. All right, so go ahead, Bob.
Of course, I know where your question is coming from, because the comet has such a weak gravity. How are you even coming in? But it has a little bit of gravity, so the probe can go slower and slower and slower. And I believe that they're going to actually send a little kind of a hook into the material and kind of hold on by a bunk, you know, the way you'd harpoon a whale.
Yeah, I heard they were going to drill in, more or less, with the legs of this probe, will drill in and sort of anchor itself.
So that's cool. The other part of the craft is going to continue to stay at a distance and keep photographing it. And if you landed anywhere else, on an asteroid, on a planet, and then watched it, okay, that's one thing. But because comets change so dramatically as they get closer to the sun and develop that million-mile-long tail, we're going to actually watch the ice turn to steam. It never melts, because in space you can't have liquid water. Instead, we watch steam starting to go psh, psh, from the ground and come up. And this is so exciting.
Cool. Thanks for the call. Bye.
Okay.
Bye-bye. 1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number. So this probe was sent by the European Space Agency, right?
Yes.
And it's been going for 10 years.
Right. It wasn't easy.
I saw a tremendous picture taken by this probe as it was going toward the rendezvous, in which you can see the comet sort of in the foreground, and then in the distance, Saturn. It's a great shot, but it just shows you how far out that thing went.
Yeah, I didn't see that. That's so nice.
All right, let's go to Laz in Great Barrington. Laz, you're up.
Lev.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, the magnetic shift, referencing that, I've heard that a magnetic shift, like a direct hit of a solar flare, could shut down communication satellites, kind of foreshadowing the geek revolution, you know. I mean, so the cell phones and computers would be rendered useless under those conditions?
Well, yeah, a strong solar flare or a CME, a coronal mass ejection, wreaks havoc on Earth. Bad for our communications, bad for especially high frequency, the HF band that jets use to communicate. And
But would a magnetic shift? I read that a magnetic shift can do the same thing.
Here's what we're thinking. You know, we're not sure. There's been 153 of these observed over many millions of years, not in modern times, because they usually happen three times every million years. Sometimes you can get one every 30,000 years, and sometimes 50 million years have to pass before there's one. And here's something cool: people think that the poles are shifting, the magnetic poles are flipping. It's called a chron. A chron is developing, but we've learned that it takes about 10,000 years for the poles to shift.
Yeah.
So even if it had started, let's say, when the last ice age happened, it still would not have fully established itself now. So it's one of those slow things when the poles of Earth flip, the magnetic poles reverse polarity. And it's now thought that during that time, instead of having no protection from incoming cosmic rays and such, we do maintain a magnetic field. It's just an irregular magnetic field that comes and goes with different orientations until the final one is held in place. And the reason we think that is that there are no consequences to life on Earth during those times. We see the geologic record, and there are no mass extinctions. There are no bad things that happen. So it can't be a very bad effect. Plus, we've learned that our atmosphere is the main protection against radiation and cosmic rays. And the magnetic field that we have is like a secondary. It's like a nice thing to have, like a professional carpet cleaning. It's like you don't really need it, but it's kind of nice to have. So even if it did get weak for a while, it's not the end of the world.
Still, not at the end of the world, but an interesting point by Lev on the line says, what will this do to worldwide communications?
That's true. But remember, we're talking about a 10,000-year process, that once a pole starts, the question is it beginning? And some people say, well, since our own magnetic field has gotten 10% weaker since the year 1848, maybe that's a sign of it. Or maybe the fact that our poles are moving in location faster than they ever have, that since we started observing them, maybe that's a sign. But others say, we have no idea what's normal.
Okay.
Maybe a fluctuation of 10% up or down is perfectly normal, and maybe sometimes the poles change their location rapidly, sometimes slowly.
Yeah.
We don't know what the norm is, so we don't know if we're living in an unusual time.
All right, let's go to Lynn in Shelburne Falls. Lynn, you're on with Bob Berman.
Hi, Ray and Bob. I've got a question for Mr. Berman. And first of all, that pole changing stuff is really, really intense to me. It must change all kinds of things. But I'm wondering how fast we're doing it. And that little girl who called actually answered some of my questions about... Oh, shoot.
That's all right. You want to go back on hold and recompose?
Okay, thank you.
All right, fair enough. Let's see. We'll go over to John in Ludwell. Hi, John. You're on.
Hey, hi. How are you today?
Good.
I got a question about the Milky Way. Do you think that, you know, perhaps sometime in the future they will put less caramel and more nougat in the Milky Way?
That's a great question. So the caramel and the nougat question. An important question, Bob.
There are some celestial candies. We got the Mars bar.
Right.
That's right. So, so there's not a real question. It's a joke question, right? Or do you have a real question about the Milky Way? I like Milky Way bars. They're good.
Fair enough. John, is there a real question here, or is it just hilarity 101?
just the 101.
All right, man. Thanks a lot. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. Stephen in Kingston, you're up.
Hi, good afternoon, guys.
Hi.
You were just talking about how the ice on the comet goes immediately to steam when it gets close to the sun. And I think you mentioned there can't be any liquids in space. And
right.
I was hoping right on that point because I wasn't aware of that. And I'm going to hang up and listen to your response.
All right, Stephen.
Right. Liquid water is kind of a weird compound, even though it's the most common compound in the universe, H2O, in that liquid not only exists at a very narrow temperature range. We all know what it is. Liquid starts at 32 degrees Fahrenheit and then boils into steam at 212. That's a pretty narrow range, 180 degrees. By the way, that's not a coincidence that it's liquid for 180 degrees.
Why?
Because when Daniel Fahrenheit was first creating his scale back then, the 180 degrees were opposites. You know, Ray, how like 180
degrees. You turn 180 degrees on an issue, you've made it about face.
That's right, right.
Right.
So 180 degrees was considered opposite. So he deliberately made the scale so that 180 of his degrees would represent the change from turning ice to turning steam.
I'll be darned.
Because he considered them opposite. So it's not a coincidence. But water not only requires that very narrow temperature, water only exists under pressure. So that on Mars, the ice caps can supply that if there's any water under the surface. On Jupiter's moon, Europa, there's oceans, but only under ice sheets that supply the pressure. Here on Earth, our atmosphere pushes down on us and supplies the pressure. But what's cool is that as you go up a tall mountain higher and higher and there's less pressure, water doesn't want to be water anymore. So quicker and quicker and quicker, it'll want to turn into steam or vapor.
Mm-hmm.
And the boiling point starts to go down and goes down by a whole degree for every 500 feet that you climb. So those of us in our listening area that live, let's say, 1,000 feet up, that boiling point is already 2 degrees less. And coffee just can't be made as hot as people down here in Albany have it, because water will just boil 2 degrees less. And once you get up, let's say, to the top of Mount Washington, it's now you're talking about maybe 16 degrees less. So in space or on the moon, when there's no pressure, you can't have liquid water. It just, when you have ice, the ice will go right from ice, right to steam, right to vapor, skip the whole water step.
All right, let's go over now. I think Lynn is back in Shelburne Falls. Lynn, you're up. Hello? Lynn? Let's try it again here. Hello, Lynn in Shelburne Falls. You're on the radio. Lynn! Oh, boy, we lost Lynn again. All right. All right, now Michael's gone. Now, we're having some problems here. Let's pick a line, Bob, because we don't know who's where. Hi, who's this?
You hear me? Lynn.
Oh, wait. All right, now I really don't know what's going on.
You
all right, Lynn,
now.
You're up.
Oh, okay. I'm so sorry that that happened.
That's fine.
Hello?
Hello.
Bob and Ray again.
Hi.
And thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
It was about the landing on the comet.
Yeah.
That kind of still disturbs me. When you touch anything or drag anything, it's going to change. I'm a carpenter by trade, and you move it just a teeny, weeny, tiny, teeny width, and after, 2 yards, it's going to look like a huge amount. You know, after light years, it's going to move a huge amount. Even it moves just a little tiny bit, if it's not completely level, it will move over a certain area. and change.
Well, that was my original fear, but Bob says it's going to be all right.
Yeah. Now, think of like a flea jumping on your leg. We're thinking of it because we just got our dog back from a friend who's looking over, and the dog came back with fleas.
Oh, great. Do you have fleas? Now, because Studio A hasn't been fumigated.
We had to do the whole carpet thing and clean the carpet thing because we were starting to get fleas. But,
what a bummer.
You know, when they jump onto your leg, they don't really push you. You don't really move. You flinch because it itches, but they don't really move. And so us landing on a comet or on another planet, yeah, that's true. We're touching it, but it's like a flea jumping on your leg. We're not really going to move the comet because the weight of the spacecraft compared to the million ton. I'm making that up because I don't know how many tons the comet is, but an object 2 miles across might be a million tons. And so the spacecraft landing on it might be a few hundred pounds. And it's landing on it very gently. So it's really not going to.
So the relative impact is not going to be anything like kind of being off level.
But no, when they talk about possibly diverting asteroids that are so-called killer asteroids on a path for Earth, they talk about nudging it just a little bit.
Yeah, but then you'd have to nudge it with, you're going to use an explosive force, you're going to use something a lot more because you're trying to nudge it. Lynn kept using the word level, which was interesting to me because, Lynn, you know that in space there's no up and down, there's no slanted or right or left. So
the equivalent would be in orbit.
Yeah, so it's negligible.
Okay.
Because of the disparity of the mass between the two objects. If you want to really change something, you want to make up for your low mass when you want to move something, you make up for it by a greater velocity of impact.
Sure.
But here you've got neither. You've got a low velocity and a low mass
onto the comet. But distance makes a difference.
Okay. And now, basically, by extension, you can't do carpentry in space.
Well, I don't know that's true. I don't know
right.
if that's true.
Yeah.
Lynn, thank you very much for the call. Let's go over to Edward in Heath. Edward, you're up.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question about how to please 7 or 8 year olds with a telescope. I've got an 80 millimeter refractor, and I've got a pretty clear view of if the weather works out fine. I've got a pretty good view of the southern sky, and I wanted to know, aside from Saturn, which is a sure bet with 8 year olds, what other celestial objects are there that I could show them? Again, given it's an 80 millimeter refractor, so it's not as powerful as might be expected. But
but a 3.1-inch refractor—that's a good device. And I was going to say Saturn, but then you took the words out of my mouth because that's always a crowd pleaser.
How about the Pleiades?
Pleiades are good at low power. Use the eyepiece that has the highest number on it. That'll be your lowest magnification. But the moon, for all of the it's so prosaic, the moon. Everyone's heard of the moon, but you watch the moon in any phase except for full, and that always produces oohs and ahs.
Well, it's probably full tonight, I think.
A couple of nights good to look at
in full?
No. Full is the one time you don't want to look at it. That'll be Sunday night.
Too bright?
Full. No, it's not that it's bright. It's that the sunlight shines straight down on it, and it washes off all the relief and makes the craters and the mountains.
You need the shadows.
Disappear.
Good advice.
Yeah, so the moon is probably the best thing on any phase, but full. Even tonight, it'll still be good. We'll just start losing the detail Saturday night. Saturday, Sunday, and Monday will be the bad nights.
And that's the supermoon.
That's the supermoon.
Let's talk about the supermoon. Okay. Hey, Edward, thank you for the call. So the supermoon, it's a big deal.
Yeah, it's a big deal. And, on the one hand, it's a big deal. On the other hand, it's not. The big deal part of it is that this is the closest moon in 3.5 years. It's been March of 2011 since the moon came this close. What's cool is that the moon changes its shape of its orbit as it goes around us. It doesn't have one shape orbit. It goes from a rounder orbit to a more stretched out elliptical orbit when it's on line with the Earth and the sun. When there's a straight line up, the moon's a path changes its shape. So this weekend, that path is going to get extreme. So the moon will get to its closest, not just of the year, not just of the last few years, but 3.5 years on the same hour that it's full.
But is it that much bigger when you're looking at it?
11%.
Really?
Compared to the moon last January. Now, 11%, you think, well, you could see that easily. But if you had the two side by side, if we had January full moon and this one coming up on Sunday night side by side, you'd just barely be able to see the difference. What's really going to do it is the moon illusion, the fact that it's a psycho-optical effect when any object's near the horizon, it looks enormous.
Yeah.
So when that moon rises, and on Saturday night you're going to see it also, that'll be at about 7:30. That would be the best time to watch it then. Look low in the east. Find a place with a clear, unobstructed view of the mm-hmm. eastern horizon. Sunday, very nearly 8 o'clock, it'll rise at 10 minutes to 8 here in the Albany area. Figure by 8 o'clock, it'll clear the low horizon stuff. Just watch that by 8:15, even if you have a little bit of a blocked horizon, you should be able to see it. But look for that on Sunday night, 8 o'clock or so, and the moon will look huge. So part of that will be the fact that it is huge, the largest full moon in years, and part of it will be the moon illusion where things just look larger when they're low. In fact, the Big Dipper at around midnight these nights, that's when it's at its lowest, scraping the northern horizon, and it looks like a Big Dipper.
Yeah.
Because it's low. We're used to psychologically assigning things near the horizon a greater size because we know they're distant, and so in our minds, they become bigger. And so the moon, when we see it juxtaposed against distant hills or treetops or things, we give it a bigger size than when it's dwarfed by the 180-degree hugeness of the sky.
But we've talked about this before. There is absolutely no effect of the atmosphere acting as a lens and making it look bigger when it's very low.
No, no. What the atmosphere sometimes does is distorts its shape so that it looks like it's got a fatter diameter than a polar diameter. It changes from a circular disk, and the moon is one of the most perfectly round objects in the known universe. It's only out of round by 4 miles mm-hmm. out of its 2,160-mile diameter. So it's very, very round, and it goes out of round when it's near the horizon. That's what the air does.
Let's take a break here. Bob Berman is our guest. His new book is Zoom, How Everything Moves. We'll get back to more of your astronomy-related questions in a moment. 1-800-348-2551.
Support comes from Quality Foreign Car Care, Ballston Spa, New York. Sales and service of Audi, BMW, Mercedes, Volvo, Saab, Volkswagen, and Porsche. QFCC.com. Unison Arts, New Paltz, a hula hoop workshop for kids and adults with Brooklyn-based acrobatic hoop dance duo, The Mandalias, Saturday, August 16th at 11. UnisonArts.org. Wild Birds Unlimited Nature Shop, Saratoga Springs, New York, helping to bring nature closer with Eagle Optics, Vortex, and Nikon binoculars and spotting scopes. 518-226-0071. And the Black Sheep, downtown Amherst, a New York-style delicatessen and European-style all-butterscratch bakery, caterer, and cafe offering fair trade coffee. BlacksheepDeli.com.
Fox Pop on WAMC. Bob Berman is our guest. I'm Ray Graff. Number to call is 1-800-348-2551. So the supermoon, the moon will be the closest it has been in 3.5 years. That means big tides, right? High tides will be big.
Yes, yes. And they're particularly big the day after the lunar influence. So on Sunday, but especially on Monday, we should have amazing tides. People who live near the beach or even in the Hudson.
Wow. Course. Yeah, being an estuary. Absolutely. Very nice. All right, let's go back to the phones. We go to Michael in Rhinebeck. Michael.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
So I have two questions, one that came up while we were listening. It's a quick one. When the water sublimates, when it skips a phase change, does it exchange just as much energy as going through two changes in that one skip, or is it a different calculation?
No, that's a great question. I love that question, that there is an energy. It takes energy to change its phase. It's not just that, okay, you gain a degree, a second degree, a third degree, and now you've suddenly gone from, let's say, ice to water, from water to steam, that there is energy that's required or given up on the phases. So in sublimation, is there twice as much required to go? And I don't know the answer. You know, I don't know the answer. That's a great, great question.
Hey,
find
Michael,
out the answer and let us know.
Save that for the physicists on the science forum.
No, that's right up my alley. But I like that. I've never been asked that. I never thought about that. That's great.
So you do some homework for next show?
Yeah.
Okay.
And the next question?
The next question is about, I heard part of a report about these radio bursts that they've just confirmed that they were picking up at some new telescope coming from deep space. And I wanted I didn't get to hear the whole report, but it sounded kind of interesting. It wasn't a pulsar. It was something different. And I was hoping you could talk about it.
Well, I've not seen that report either. This is great. 0-2 on this caller.
Way to go.
I have not seen that report. So do you know in what part of the electromagnetic spectrum it was, if I can say that word, electromagnetic?
What was the frequency, Kenneth, is what he wants to know.
You know, it was a frequency that they just reconfirmed, because they had picked it up a while ago. Talking out the side of my head.
I remember seeing this, too. There was a telescope that picked it up, I believe, right, in Australia, and scientists said, well, we think it might be an artifact of your setup. But it was confirmed, right, I believe, at the big array in Puerto Rico.
Was it galactic or extragalactic?
Extragalactic.
Oh, it was extragalactic. That's right.
Far away.
Far, far away.
Well, maybe somebody else will have more details than you and I have, Michael. But thanks a lot for the call.
Bye.
Have a good one. Let's go to Simone on line one. Simone, from where are you calling?
Woodsboro, New York.
Nice to have you here. You're on.
My question is, how do comets form?
Well, we think these are leftover items from the birth of the solar system, that they're as old as you can possibly get. We think that these are chunks of ice. Remember, ice is the most common compound in the universe, so ice is not unusual. And that when we first formed out of a solar nebula in the outer parts of the solar system, it was cold enough for there to be chunks of ice, and that there's an entire Oort cloud, named after Jan Oort, who first theorized it, that exists as a spherical halo surrounding the entire solar system. So it takes a nudging or a gravitational influence of one from the other, and then some of these will come inward and then visit the inner solar system. So they're old stuff. This is very old material.
Okay. Thanks.
Thanks, Simone. We appreciate the call. 1-800-348-2551. Let's see. Let's go to Kurt in Glenville. Kurt, you're on.
Yes, hi. I had a question for you about refraction. I'm one of those rare people. I'm still using the art of celestial navigation. And one of the corrections we do when we shoot a celestial body when it's down near the horizon is for refraction. You had indicated earlier that the bodies are actually the same size optically. I'm not sure if I agree with that, or could you clarify the phenomena or the correction of refraction, which I thought was a distortion increase in the apparent size of a body because of the atmospheric effect on the horizon.
Now, what the refraction does, a great question that you're asking, is, as you know, there is a 1/2 degree deflection at the horizon in the position that we're seeing of the body. So it's a change in where it seems to be located. As you probably well know, refraction is due to the change in the speed of light, objects moving through the medium of the atmosphere. So light speed is changing depending upon the wavelength of the light, the color of the light, and that changes its apparent position. So on the horizon, things are shifted by 0.5 degree as you go up higher and higher. As you well know, using celestial navigation, it gets less and less. It becomes essentially negligible by the time you're 45 degrees up from the horizon. But the moon, being 0.5 degree wide, the entire moon is being refracted differently depending upon the part of the surface that we're looking at. And the effect is to keep its apparent diameter the same, but keep its polar diameter, the diameter of the equator appears larger than the polar diameter. So it produces a distortion. We see it in the sun, of course, as well, in that the sun looks like it's got a big fat belly, and the moon does the same thing compared to its polar diameter. But when you actually measure the apparent size, what you're getting is an increase in size as the moon gets higher and higher. An increase. The moon illusion makes it seem as if the moon is large near the horizon, gets smaller when it's larger. But an actual, using a filar micrometer or some accurate measure on the moon, shows that the moon actually grows in size as it gains altitude and gets higher and higher in the sky.
I'll be darned. Kurt, that good for you?
That's completely contrary to my understanding of the optics of it. I thought the atmosphere, because of the additional, the wavelength shift, I thought that the optics of it appears bigger. But you're saying completely contrary to that. Fascinating.
Appears bigger on the horizon. It's actually bigger when it's higher.
Kurt, I would recommend that you don't change anything. If you've been finding the right place out on the ocean, you're doing something right. So
that's
I would
right.
Just keep as you were.
Right on. Thanks a bunch.
Thanks, man. All right, we have a severe thunderstorm warning here, Bob, here on planet Earth. Severe thunderstorm warning for Saratoga, Warren, and Washington counties in New York until 3:43 p.m. Severe thunderstorm warning for Saratoga, Warren, and Washington counties in New York until 3:43. Bob Berman is our guest. This is Vox Pop, 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Fred in Hurley. Fred, you're on.
Hi. I have a phenomenon that I would like to describe very quickly, hopefully. One morning, I woke up, and I was looking out my window up at a very gray, very evenly gray, very light gray sky. First thing of the dawn, and I noticed this really strange thing going on. From the corner, from every area of the window, I noticed these little, like, rods. That's all I can describe. And they were proceeding upward towards the sky in a cone fashion. And they were various colors. And I'll tell you now, I was not on anything whatsoever. And okay. And so in the meantime, and so this, I watched and I could see they were like changing at like 90 degree angles, very minuscule. But I could see them and all moving at the same rate of time towards the top of the cone. And as they got to the top of the cone, before, you know, and I would say visually in my eye, so I was like sort of like the center of the bottom of the cone kind of thing. And there was like a 1-inch hole at the top. And right as it got to that like 1-inch where it didn't complete, you know, the lines that weren't connecting, because they were connecting with each other as they kept moving forward and up.
Are you talking about something in the distance? Toward the
in the distance. Yeah, it was. And,
okay,
and,
something toward the east, towards the sunrise.
Possibly towards the sunrise, but it was, you know, a cloudy sky, and it was okay. And if I finish, you'll understand. The as it got to that where it didn't complete the top of the cone, there was a secondary moment where it didn't complete, but then all of a sudden, heat lightning. Spread across the sky.
Wow.
Thunder and heat lightning. Okay, so I'm like, this is blowing my mind, okay, because I'm seeing this happen.
Okay.
Okay, and I continue to watch the sky, and it did it again. So I witnessed it twice.
Well, would you make a sketch and maybe fax it, call the station later, and they'll give you my private number.
Oh, that's a good idea. Email it to Vox Pop.
So I can picture it. I mean, Sun Pillar comes to mind if it was around the time of sunrise as a phenomenon called
cloudy.
A Sun Pillar
but
that
it
would
was,
produce
there
a cone.
Was thunder, though. There was thunder.
And it was totally cloudy?
It was the whole sky was an even gray haze, very light gray haze, not a shred of difference in the whole sky.
It sounds like from what I'm picturing, from what you're saying, it sounds like a sun pillar, which is a phenomena that's sometimes seen around dawn. And the lightning and the thunder would have just been secondary, would have been also happening at the same time. But if you make a sketch of it,
it happened both times. The thunder happened within a split second of it not finishing the cone.
Well, I tell you, Fred, this sounds to me like it could be atmospheric phenomena, and, you know, we're this astronomy show, but very interesting. And do send it to voxpop@wamc.org, and I'll send it along to Bob. Let's go over to Oscar in Rochester. Or you're not really in. Are you in Rochester?
The first left before Gilbert Road.
Okay. All right. Hello, Oscar. Are you there?
Hi.
Okay, that's it. Sorry. I have a little patience for this. Daniel and Amherst. Daniel, you're on.
Yes, I just wanted to follow up with you guys on the question that was left open about the latent heat involved in sublimation.
Oh, great, and, great. Fabulous.
Yeah, I'm a recent mechanical engineering grad, so this stuff is fresh in my mind.
Perfect.
When you have sublimation without much of a temperature change, then you're not dealing with putting energy per mass into changing the temperature, but you're still going through the sublimation, which is both the latent heat of fusion and the latent heat of vaporization. And in the case of water, it's actually 7 times more energy or thereabouts to go through the vaporization than it would be to go through the fusion step.
So I hope our previous caller is listening to this to answer its question of whether it requires more energy to skip the step and go to sublimation rather than first turning into a liquid and then turning into the vapor state of water. That was the question, and you've answered it. So you're saying seven times more.
Seven times more for the vaporization than fusion, yes.
Way to go, Daniel. Thank you for calling.
Okay, and thanks for the airtime. Have a good one.
Appreciate it. 1-800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Bob Berman is the guest. Sean in Fort Ann. Sean, you're on.
Howdy. Just wanted to know, why is it that the solar system is on a flat plane as opposed to being spherical? Why are we all basically on the same plane?
Great question.
Well, it's thought that it's simply the conservation of angular momentum, that if you're getting a rotating system like the solar nebula, where the solar system first formed out of a condensing cloud of a mixture of materials from one, materials left over from a supernova explosion, and two, a hydrogen cloud that was just minding its business in this vicinity, and the combination of those two interacting. Once you have the collapsing near the center just from gravity, eventually producing the sun in the middle, the leftover material, everything is revolving. And just like if you place a blob of jelly on a turntable, it starts spinning.
Yeah.
That jelly is not going to just remain there piled high. It's going to turn flatter and flatter just because everything has its own rotation speed. So just from the conservation of angular momentum, you're going to get a flattening, and we see this commonly. And so, but some parts of the solar system escape this. Farther away, where the rotation speeds were really, really slow, like in the Oort cloud, that's why we still remain, this is why this question is a good one from Sean, we still have a sphere surrounding us of the Oort cloud of primordial comet material, because that's far enough away to have escaped the process of flattening.
Okay, Sean.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. 1-800-348-2551 as we wrap up here the last few minutes with Bob Berman. Rebecca in Highland. Rebecca, you're on.
Hi. I had an interesting experience recently, which I will describe.
Okay.
I took a flight on a commercial aircraft, and it was cloudy, and we climbed up above the clouds. And once we were up above the clouds, I looked
glory.
Down.
The glory?
Is that what it's called? Yes. I looked down and there was a silhouette of the plane.
And surrounding the silhouette, can I tell you what you saw and then you tell me if I'm right?
Yeah.
Surrounding the silhouette of the plane, there were a series of concentric circles, colorful rings, beautiful rings of color that perfectly surrounded not just the shadow of the plane, but perfectly surrounded the part of the shadow in which you were seated.
Oh, well, that I didn't notice.
Yes, that's what's cool about that. Those colorful concentric circles, especially when you're just above the clouds and the shadow of the plane is large enough, if you're seated behind the wings, for example, near the tail, those circles surround not just the shadow, but surround the tail of the plane. They're perfectly...
Also, maybe that's why I didn't notice it, because I was about in the middle of the plane. So it was sort of centered on the plane itself.
Yes, that phenomenon is called the glory. And it used to only be seen before the advent of air travel. It was a very rare phenomenon. People would be up in the Alps, for example, and looking down on a layer of fog below them, and they'd see the shadow of their head on the fog, and their head would be surrounded by rings as if they had been acquired sainthood. And there were these halos surrounding their head. So it was very rare. Now in the advent of air travel, people who look for this see this, and it's beautiful. When you see it, don't jump up and yell, "I see the glory," by the way, in the plane.
Yeah, that's probably not a good plan. The air marshals will be on you. All right, Bob, last thing here before we wrap up. A question came in via email from Adam in someplace in the 845. I believe that the last time you were on, you said that space dust can be caught in a bucket of water during a meteor shower. Can you explain how that's done and when the next opportunity for that would be?
I did not say that. That was somebody else. That was a different me.
I think that was a science form.
Oh, okay. Well, it's true that tons, and one estimate is that a million tons, but there's such disparate estimates that I don't know which is true, of dust settles on the planet because of not just a meteor shower. Actually, meteor showers are mostly comet ices, and they have less dust than we get from just the sporadic meteors that come in that are a lot of them are asteroids. But yeah, they turn into dust, and the dust settles, or in the case of comets, they turn into water vapor. It could be that Earth's oceans came from that, came from all this stuff settling on the Earth in the form of dust and water vapor. And a tiny percentage of, if you put a bucket of water outside, a tiny percentage of the dust that's going to settle came from space.
Fascinating. Well, Bob, we're out of time. The new book is Zoom, How Everything Moves. It's on Little Brown. Thanks for calling today. Support comes from Oh My International Arts Center, Ghent, New York. Dancers and residents showing in the Field Sculpture Park Saturday, August 23rd from 2 to 4 p.m. Open to the public, artomai.org. College Street Motors, Amherst, Massachusetts, specializing in foreign and domestic car and truck repair services and 24-hour towing and recovery service for over 30 years, collegestreetmotors.com, and Metroland, an alternative news weekly serving New York's Capital Region and Western Massachusetts. Thanks to everyone once again for calling and, of course, listening. Thanks to Bob Berman for being here. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Your phones were answered by Aubrey Mulvey, of course. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, by the way, boys and girls, it's a Food Friday. And oh, what fun we shall have. The news is next.